Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and I'm so delighted that you've been able to join me today. We are going into a topic today that really is going to stretch your mind and your thinking. If you are an individual that has a passion for science fiction, if you absolutely yearn to perhaps travel into space, as so many millions of people have visualized in their minds, especially when Star Trek came out, this is something that we're going to be discussing today. This is a topic, the topic we're going to be covering, interplanetary space travel. We've seen it all in science fiction, but can it really have already happened? Are there people today that have actually experienced interplanetary travel? My guest, Lynn Kasten, has put together a book called The Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. He says this is a true story of interplanetary travel. I think you're going to find the subject matter interesting. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Donna. Nice to be with you.
You are a man that is what I would describe as a questioner. You are not satisfied with pat answers, and obviously you're being a researcher and investigator into UFOs, which simply means unidentified flying objects. This has caused you to step into the realm of what's considered the unknown, but discovering a lot of things that most people would say, you're full of imagination. This can't possibly be. And I just was sharing with someone just a few moments ago that I was going to be chatting with you, and I told them about the book, and they said, oh, science fiction, this is fiction. And I said, oh, this should be really fun to talk about today. Lynn, what was it that got you into the state of mind where you decided you were going to really check out this story about interplanetary travel? How did this come into your environment?
Well, I've been researching these subjects for 25 years at least, probably more. And I was in the habit of attending the annual UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, where I would meet UFO researchers from all over the world every year. One particular meeting, I met with Bill Ryan, and sat and talked with him for 2 hours. This was in 2006, and he related this entire story to me. And I did some additional research and some additional investigation and determined that this was indeed a true story. And so I continued to do the research and wrote the book.
How long did it take for you to be able to amass the information? So this doesn't sound like something out of woo-woo land.
Well, if you read the book, you know about the website. Did you read the book? You know about the website, I gather.
Well, I'm aware of the website, but for those that are not, that's why I'm asking the question, because whenever you get into this type of a topic, when you hear about Project Crystal Knight, the Red Book, and other terminology, it smacks so many times in the minds of many. Oh, my goodness, here we go again. We already had the stuff back in the 70s about the Blue Book, and all of these things are just, again, figments of someone's imagination. But that is not where you're coming from. That's not how you work.
No, not at all, not at all. This information was sent out to a network of UFO insiders, you might call them insiders, ex-government people. It was sent out in November of 2005 by somebody who called himself Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And he proceeded to send out 14 emails to this network, and then he continued to send out more and more information until the volume of it, of detail got to be extraordinary. He was an ex-DIA employee. He was retired, but he was speaking on behalf of five other DIA ex-officials, some of whom were still working with the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. The DIA was in charge of this operation in 1965. They were the ones who were tasked by President Kennedy to oversee this amazing story where we sent 12 American military people to a distant planet for a period of 10 years. It turned out to be 13 years because they lost track of time. And so it was leaked to that website. It was leaked to that that group of UFO insiders. And then they decided they wanted to give it its own website. And that website became www.serpo.org. And it was moderated and hosted by Bill Ryan. And Bill was the one who told me the entire story in Laughlin, Nevada in 2006, which was the following year. So the information is now out there, and it's been confirmed by a lot of other people. So it's no longer in the category of speculation.
We are living in times where, because of technology, information is communicated so quickly, so efficiently. Good, bad, or indifferent, it is there, available for people. This is something that evolved in the 1960s. You go in to so much history. You talk about how their anti-gravity disks, flying saucers, however you want to call them, were out and about long before Roswell. Well, I think that there has been an awareness that this is something that's been going on actually for a long, long time, if not centuries. But the Germans were so far ahead of everyone in their technological development. And there is a man by the name of Karl Haushofer that you speak about in this book. Who is this man, and why is he so significant in this story?
Well, he was really the basis of Nazi Germany. He was really the one who picked Hitler and put him in power, more or less. I refer to him as the godfather of Nazi Germany. He himself had contact with a group of people in Tibet. And there's an underground civilization in Tibet that many people now know about that involves alien habitation. And somehow Haushofer made that connection. And the technology that the Germans took advantage of came from that civilization. And Haushofer was the intermediary. So that's how the Nazis got their hands on the flying saucer technology. And they were building them all through the war. They couldn't get them to work in battle, in air battles, but they had developed a very sophisticated version. And by 1945, they had a huge one that was about 250 feet in diameter and was capable of outer space travel. However, by that time, the Allies were closing in, and they were bombing Germany, and they had to terminate their research along those lines. But they did move it all to Antarctica. And so I have an entire chapter on the Nazi colony in Antarctica, which was started in 1938.
You bring up a researcher, Dr. Eric Wang, and you talk about this technology development at Wright-Patterson. Now, this is a man that was brilliant. There was also a Victor Schauberger, an Austrian scientist. And we, the United States, took him and out of his environment and brought him here into the United States to work on an anti-gravity disk. Now, if you were to talk to anybody in science today, they would say, nah, it doesn't exist. However, when I was working with a particular company in California, this goes back into the 1970s, and there was a gentleman that I knew that was a brilliant scientist, and I'll never forget, he walked me into his office one day, was showing me all kinds of photos from outer space. And he said people have no idea what's really going on. And he wouldn't go into detail because he was part of a particular group that just was so far beyond the average person. This man was a genius. And you would never know that he had all of this knowledge. And my goodness, that was back in the 70s. He said there's just so much.
What company was that?
It was a company in, it was a photo processing firm in Glendale, California. It's no longer there. But it was called Rapid Color. Yeah.
And well, I might just point out that Ben Rich, who was the president of Lockheed Skunk Works, they called them the Skunk Works because they were doing the top secret development for Lockheed aircraft. In 1998, Rich made a speech to his alumni group at the University of California in which he said the following. He said, "We now have the ability to travel among the stars." He said, We now have the ability to take E.T. home, but this technology is locked up in top-secret information so tight that it would take an act of God to get it out. Now, that was in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
That was 15 years ago. If we were traveling among the stars in 1998, can you imagine what we're doing now?
Mm-hmm. Well,
he was in a position to know. He was the president of the company.
Mm-hmm. See, what fascinates me is that we are living in an age where so many people, there are so many things that are hidden. There are so many things that come to light. And there seems to be the 50-year rule. And it's like, we'll keep it under wraps for 50 years and then we can advance. We're seeing advancements in so many areas of medicine. There were inventions done in the early 1900s that were just ignored that could be used today, that were far in advance of their time. And we're not talking about ridiculous woo-woo stuff. We're talking about items using electromagnetic energy, being able to affect cellular growth, development, you know, bringing tools for healing, all kinds of things. Finally, we're beginning to see some of this, but an anti-gravity capability for travel, being able to actually have the Star Trek experience, being able to change, let's say, the electrical frequencies that are causing so much harm at this time with cell towers and to using energy in a way where it's not going to harm animals, it's not going to harm people. All of this is so important. And yet we just seem to be caught in a quagmire of, what do I want to say, mental peanut butter, because of all of these rulings that are made. You talk about the Reagan briefings and 54 audio cassette tapes that were finally made available for people to listen to, and you have documentation of that in your book. It is, what is it, what do you think it's going to take for us to really be able to get an understanding with this? We are evolving. We've got so much secret underground activities occurring. A lot of people just wonder, how can we find out about this? Your book goes a long way in expressing that, but what can we do?
Well, you know, this program where we sent 12 Americans to a distant planet was in 1965, and that was 50 years ago. It was kept secret for the 25-year compulsory period for the declassification of top-secret information. The final report on this program was written in 1980. So Anonymous, the person that released this information, released it exactly 25 years after that final report was written, because that was the required time for the declassification. And that's why it took 25 years to release it. But it's out there now, and it's public information now. And all I did was put it all together and put it in book form. But you can actually go out to the website itself, which is still there, www.serpo.org, and read all this information. There's 13,000 words out there.
And that's exciting.
It's all there.
That is exciting. Now, with the information in your book, Secret Journey to the Planet Serpo, you talk about the training of the astronauts at that time. And it was, there was a statement, there were no women involved in this. But that wasn't true, was it?
Well, in the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if you remember the last scene, there were two women that boarded the alien craft. Spielberg had all that information, by the way. However, mm-hmm. what happened was they trained 16 people, even though they were only going to send 12. Four of them were alternates. In that group of alternates, two of them were women. However, and it's still controversial, by the way, but it's my belief that in the final 12, they were all men, that the mm-hmm. two women were eliminated and did not make the final cut.
Now, with the diary that was kept, and then there were audio recordings that were made by the individuals that traveled here, this is something you have. There is a small scale called a speculative model of an antimatter reactor that you have in your book. You also talk about how some of the astronauts actually died. The information about what it was like living on this other planet and the communication between the Americans and the ETs. This is something that I found extremely interesting because it is, again, you're entering into a different world. I thought, boy, Gene Roddenberry really had it together. And
yes, he did. Yes, he did. And, he got some inside information.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was working with I interviewed a young physicist that became one of the script writers. I mean, we have people that are so brilliant from around the world that are working on things that the average person just doesn't have any idea of. And those are people that were often contacted to provide material for Star Trek or and
yeah,
it's absolutely amazing.
Right.
Yes, it's absolutely amazing. Now let's talk about some of the challenges that the astronauts had when they were in Serpo. There was disorientation. They physically just had a great many challenges because of the environment. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, they had to endure extreme heat because the temperature at the equatorial belt where they landed was in the neighborhood of about 110 to 120 degrees, which the Ebens, they were called Ebens, by the way, that was the name we gave to them. The Ebens found that to be comfortable, but the Americans did not. Eventually, they were moved to the northern quadrant of the planet where it was much cooler, and the Ebens built a community for them up there near the North Pole, and they were able to live there comfortably until the time had expired for them to go back. But for a long time, they had to endure extreme heat, very, very high radiation levels. They had to eat all the foreign food. They lived on sea rations for a long time, but eventually they had to start eating the alien food, which was absolutely tasteless to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to endure all of these problems, and of the 12 that left, only 7 returned. One died on the way to Serpo, 2 died on the planet, and 2 decided to remain there. So only 7 came back.
That's interesting that 2 decided to remain there. I find
it,
when you look at the films, the sci-fi films that have been produced through the years, it has just been my observation that there's just sort of a preparation for what we're evolving into. And I really think that Spielberg, in fact, you go into quite a bit of this, that Spielberg was actually put on the hot seat because of what he had done with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and the understanding that music was a communication factor, tone were a way of communicating. And all of this information. Now, when that movie came out, people by the millions went to watch it. They just fell in love with it. It's like they totally got it. It's an amazing patterning that I have seen evolving through the years. And it's just like your book coming out with all of this information. It's really intriguing, and it's almost to the point where I think the younger generations that are coming up today say, well, what's the big deal? Yeah, naturally that's going to happen because there's been all of this preparation. And the Ebens themselves were quite interesting because on the part of observation, the commanding officer and the records that were kept, is that this was a people, a wonderful, wonderfully intelligent group of people, but they didn't seem to have creativity. And I made a note that they just weren't into being individuals. And I thought, it sounds like something out of the Twilight Zone. But it really, it's a very interesting phenomenon that just because someone's
intelligent. Yeah, they had a very unique civilization. They were completely controlled. I made the point in the book that they were really, it really was a police state. They were highly regimented. Our people never really got to meet the elite people on the planet. They were not brought to meet them. So they really dealt only with the populace. And they were totally controlled, totally regimented, but they were highly intelligent. We estimated the average IQ to be about 180 of the average even.
You have a few pages where the dark side of the civilization is discussed, and this has been a matter that has been really controversial here on this planet of ours, and that's genetic engineering. And I think, I don't remember the name of the writer that wrote The Island of Dr. Moreau, but genetic engineering, and this was a long time ago that was written, and I remember coming across this old classic, and I thought, wow, when I finished reading it, this is too close to the truth. And I thought, when I was reading this section about the dark side of this culture, it directly related to genetic engineering. And that's just been in the discussion in the past few weeks that I've heard commentaries.
Well, you know, what our people thought was evil was simply advanced science, really. They didn't view it as evil. They had DNA technology well developed, and they were creating hybrid creatures from the creatures that they were taking from other planets. And this civilization has been roving around the galaxy for thousands of years and bringing back specimens and using those specimens in their bioengineering program. But our people were so astounded at what they were doing that they thought it was evil. Of course, at the time, we had no knowledge of DNA. These men went to CERPO in 1965, and we had just really discovered DNA at that point, only a few years earlier. So they did not know what to make of it. They saw them developing these hybrid creatures, and they thought it was evil. And the commander said, "I have seen the dark side of this civilization."
It has been of utmost interest on my part that the Vatican has been very, very much aware of many things that they would not share with people. And there was a Monsignor Balducci who has since passed away, but he was an outspoken person when it came to saying, yes, we've had visitors from outer space, and this type of an attitude. I'm surprised they didn't throw him out of the church, but
because the Catholic Church now realizes that they have to make these admissions. They can no longer keep this secret. As a matter of fact, they're not reluctant to do that at all. Now, the Ebens have returned to Earth 10 times since 1978. And at one of those meetings, the one in 2009, Vatican representatives were invited. We invited them to meet the aliens. And so they've known all about them at least since that time. Balducci, I think, died right around that time. But You know, the Vatican has a observatory right here in Arizona that they've been using for many, many years, and they know a lot more about these subjects than they're allowing people to know.
Carl Sagan, this is a name that's well known by just about anybody involved in the world of science, and of course he achieved phenomenal international renown with his various books and his television exposure, all of this. And I can remember listening to him and thinking, you're just not saying the truth. Something just isn't about so many of the things that he promoted. And he would debunk so much stuff. It reminds me of Arthur Clarke, the same thing. Arthur Clarke would often debunk the very thing that he knew to be true. And I found this so interesting. And you brought out a point, and I bring this up for a reason. The fact that Carl Sagan would make those remarks, he didn't want people to know publicly because he wouldn't have gotten the money to fund his projects.
That's right, exactly.
And this, he got a lot of funding from NASA. And this is something, the duplicity is what I think is very confusing to people. Because I think, at best, most people want to believe what people are saying. And boy, we're getting a big, heavy castor oil dose of duplicity right now on so many levels with public officials, et cetera, that's not even related to UFOs. So here you go into this environment, and you're having the same thing.
Well, Sagan could not make these admissions in public because he was head of the Cornell Astronomical Laboratory, and they were getting funding from NASA. If he were to admit that he believed in UFOs or any of that, he would have lost credibility and probably lost his job. But he did release the information through fiction when he wrote the book Contact, and which was subsequently made into a movie with Jodie Foster.
Mm-hmm.
More or less admitting what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't do it officially. He had to walk a very fine line, and he did it his way. But don't forget, he was really the one that made us conscious of the fact that there was probably life in the galaxy when he started talking about billions and billions of planets. This was more or less raising our consciousness just by that admission alone. So he did what he could, but he couldn't do it all. He couldn't say what he knew.
Very true. But I think that's one of the significant points in your book. You bring out so much good information. Now, free energy. There is a man that my husband knew quite well. His name is Bruce De Palma. He's the brother of the De Palma that's very much involved in the movie industry. He has on his own website a machine that he left that really utilized free energy. And anybody, it's public knowledge. Anybody can go into his site. And there's a wonderful write-up about him, and they said, this is the information. Go ahead and use it. It's free energy. This is something that you bring out in the book, and this is something that we really need to become conscious of. There's a Dr. T. Henry Moray, who was just very, very dedicated to Nikola Tesla. Tesla was one of the most brilliant minds that we are aware of on this planet. And he was working with all kinds of energy. And this is something where this absolutely is possible. And to be able to make that breakthrough, I know Bruce De Palma contributed to that, Tesla contributed to that, there's many other people. Do you think we're going to have a chance of being able to do that? Well, maybe we can get rid of these cell towers that are causing so much harm to the environment and to other things so that we can...
Well, you know, the entire world economy is based on oil, and the entire banking structure is based on oil. And these huge refineries have been built all over the world. We have a tremendous investment in oil, and I don't think we're going to give that up very easily. We do have free energy. Free energy does exist. Tesla knew about it, and I made the point in my book about the fact that we already have free energy devices that have been patented, and I have a picture of one of them in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't think that, pragmatically speaking, we're going to be allowed to use it until we have figured out a way to make the transition away from an oil-based world economy. And that, by the way, that includes anti-gravity aircraft, which also do not use petroleum. So once we've made the transition to anti-gravity, using that for commercial aircraft, all of that is going to be possible once we have escaped from this oil-based economy.
It doesn't mean that it's going to disappear. It just means there's going to be the disruptive technology that will put it into a different positioning. And because oil will be utilized in one way or another. But I do think that there is so much here in your book that is absolutely provocative. And more than that, it makes sense. I mean, there, why we would think we were the only populated planet in this massive universe is beyond me. But there are people
exactly.
that do have that dimension of thinking. However, I find more people than not say, wait a minute, what else is out there? And that's why I think Star Trek, Star Wars, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Contact, all of this that has been pulled out, there has been that planting of seeds in the human psyche where people say, okay, I'm ready. When's the next bird going up? I'd love to be in it. And I really
yeah.
think that there is that shift. Lynn Creston, this has just been wonderful having you on the air. The Secret Journey to Planet Serpo is not just about interplanetary travel. It is also a real expose, I think, on how there are always those that feel like the average human being only has the brains of a cockroach. And I always say
yeah.
that tongue-in-cheek because it's not true. I don't think the average individual is an idiot. I really don't. I think they are hardworking people and whatever average is. I just find that it's throughout history, it's always been a small group that decimates, you know, all of what they want, and it takes courage, people like yourself and others, to say, wait a minute, there's got to be more out here. And I think your book goes a long way to bringing that to the forefront. And you don't have to believe in interplanetary space travel, although most of my listeners I know would, but I think it opens your mind to a reality that there's more going on in life than we actually are, let's say, encouraged to explore. And
exactly.
Lynn, your website is et-secrethistory. Now, is that .com or .org?
.com.
.com. E-T.
I have excerpts from the book out there, and you can order the book through the website, which will click. You can click through to Amazon or to the publisher, or I can have it sent out directly from me, either way. But there's a lot more information out there at the website.
Well, it's wonderful. Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. It is really eye-opening with all of the documented information that's inside of this book. Check it out. I think it will, well, I think it'll intrigue you. Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Lynn Creston, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Donna. It's been a pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
We see it every day. Courts overflowing with frivolous lawsuits. People losing all of their assets simply because they were unprepared. The best defense against unscrupulous predators and creditors is a good offense. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes and from all over the world create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Think asset protection is only for the wealthy? Think again. Our Cover Your Assets strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Industry leader Corporate Direct is owned and operated by attorney and best-selling author Garrett Sutton. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can tailor a CYA plan for you. That's CYA, Cover Your Assets, with Corporate Direct. 1-800-600-1760. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance your physical needs with your busy schedule is always a challenge. Amino muscle snack time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino muscle snack time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors. A bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. It can be used anytime, anywhere. First thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. And as a weight loss appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used. No caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon or squatsponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding amino muscle snack time by visiting Amazon.com or squatsponge.com. Visit Amazon.com or squatsponge.com for more information.
Hi, welcome back. This is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Give me a call if you'd like to chat, and if you'd like to have a free reading on the air, I'd be delighted to light up your life with some intuitive insight. Again, 888-627-6008. Well, tomorrow we're going to be talking about your feet. That's right. 21 things that you need to know about your feet and diabetes. And having had a member of my own family where I know the dreadful effects that this can have on someone, I really think this is very, very useful information. And then we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Beers on Thursday. We're going to be talking about the lost season. This is a story about a man's awakening, and it's between a professor and a bartender. Fascinating read. And then on Friday, in honor of Fathers Everywhere, we're going to be talking about how you can be a great dad no matter what kind of father you have. Very well done. Keith Zephram is my guest. So that's what's upcoming for this week. A little bit of trivia here. Do you know that the smallest park in the United States is in Portland, Oregon? That's right. It is only 24 inches in diameter. It has miniature statues, a swimming pool for butterflies, and an itsy-bitsy Ferris wheel. Mm-hmm. The smallest park, well, not just in the U.S., actually. It's in the world. And there's just so many fascinating things that go on everywhere that I just think it's so amazing. So if you have an incredible story or something that you'd like to share, then just send me an email. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com or DonnaSebo at Comcast.net, and we may be able to feature it here on the show. Yesterday, I had started telling you a story about a man who has done special reports for the Today Show, and we ran out of time, and I promised you that I would finish it today. His name is Bob Dotson, and there is a statement made that he's probably been in more hotel rooms and motel rooms than the Gideon Bible itself, which when you go into hotel motel rooms forever, there's always one of those Bibles in the room. So this guy has done a lot of traveling, and he absolutely loves it. And yesterday, when I had to cut off from the story, and for those of you that missed it, I wanted to share it with you today. This is a man who really has a passion for what he does. And what is that passion? That passion is he likes to pay attention to people that live everyday life. He finds that there's a story everywhere that he goes, no matter what town that he's in. Now, he graduated from the University of Kansas in 1968, and he, like so many young people, when they are maturing, they're naturally at odds with their parents because they're growing into their own self, and Bob was in that situation. Well, after the graduation, he and his dad happened to be sitting in a cafe, and he said it wasn't that we didn't like each other. We just couldn't communicate. We just couldn't connect. So what else is new? That's always seemed to be the case, because it's part of the process of growing up into your own self and going out into the world. Well, his dad, for the first time, he felt like he really had an in-depth conversation with his dad, and it was spurred by a comment his dad made. Now, his dad was very proud of the fact that Bob had graduated from the university, and he told his son that he had never graduated from college. But there was more to the story. Well, when he heard his dad make this statement, he couldn't believe it, because his dad was a very, very accomplished professional. And he found out that his dad had dropped out of school in the fifth grade. He said, "I had to leave school because my dad ran out on the family. My dad joined the army, never came back. So I was the head of the family. I was the male. I was the eldest. And I had to go to work to help my mother feed us." And he said, "I had a younger brother and sister. They had to be taken care of." Bob had no idea that his father had not gone to college. Again, his father was very, very accomplished. His father had an honorary master's degree in ophthalmics, and he had gone to school. His father had been in and out of classes for 23 years, and he was given an honorary degree. Now, why did he go into the eye business? Well, he was a janitor at an optical store, the father was. So his dad went into business for himself. He bought a lens grinder and opened the Dotson Optical Company. And he said that business, my father was very successful, he said, that business paid for everything. And he said it paid for my education. And he became aware of something that it gave him a whole different picture of his father. He had, you know, he had a respect for his dad, but he had no idea the sacrifices that he had made and the hard work that he had been involved with for most of his life. Now, Bob ended up working at different odd jobs after getting out of college, and he started working for an NBC station in Oklahoma City. And when he was working, his dad's story kept coming up to him, and he said, "You know, I wonder how many other people have stories that they've never told anybody." Well, it was a few years later that he had been given an assignment. It was to find out about pioneers who were African Americans and in the area of Oklahoma, the state of Oklahoma. And he wasn't finding much at all. He was doing his research, and there was a university that was built for black students in Oklahoma. And they said they didn't have much material to work with at all. They were very gracious and were happy to help him. Well, he had an African-American cameraman that was working with him. And he said, "We went across the state looking for people that remembered the early days of the black Americans in Oklahoma." He said he needed some historical footage. Well, one day he was directed into a very tiny storage area at the station itself, and he said, "Here were stacks of archived films, old celluloid films." And one box caught his eye, and it had the name of an old newsreel company on it. And he said, "That's what I wanted to look at." And he said, "Inside this box were, my goodness, the celluloid footage from the 1920s and 30s. And there was a name that was written on each one of the reels that were in this big box. And it was Benny Kent." Now, he had been a cameraman many, many years ago. And he said that most of the footage would have been sent away to New York to be edited into newsreels for national distribution. But for some reason, that wasn't done. For some reason, Benny had saved it and put all of these reels in a box. So he had to dig up an old projector. And that's not an easy thing to find. And he was able to put those old celluloid films into that old projector and watch it. And he said it was amazing. It was all black and white, of course. And he saw these old boom towns that had been filmed. There were sequences of Native Americans that were just unbelievable. This kind of footage was extremely special. And he found out about entire towns that were populated by African Americans. They were freed slaves. They were excluded from white communities, so they went and made up their own. The history was all in front of them. And this allowed them an open door to speak to several African-American families. Say, do you have anybody in your family that has records or photographs? What are their stories? And he said, it was just amazing. All of a sudden, he started hearing all of these different stories. And he made a comment, Bob did, and I think that this is so significant. He said, we all carry the weight of our own stories, good, bad, or mediocre. And we need to share those stories. And I think that's true, especially within families. He said, because when we hear the stories of people and what they've gone through, it helps us work with our own lives. And he said, everyone has a collection of their own stories, and we love each other by embracing those stories, honoring them, and learning from them. And you know what it did? He's learned, he said, because of these stories, he's learned to slow down and trust in the inherent goodness of people. He said his work has taught him every story has its own life. You tell the stories, and the rest takes care of itself. Bob Dotson, a man who is doing what he loves to do, even today. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Phone lines open, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Too many people become victims of frivolous lawsuits and scammers simply because they were unprepared. At Corporate Direct, we use the latest legal tools to help our clients of all sizes create a strategy to protect what is theirs. Asset protection is not only for the wealthy. Our strategies and tools are very affordable and practical. Give us a call at 1-800-600-1760 or go to CorporateDirect.com to see how we can help you. That's 1-800-600-1760 for CorporateDirect.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance your physical needs with your busy schedule is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors. A bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. It can be used anytime, anywhere. First thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. And as a weight loss appetite control. Only top of the line and no genetically modified ingredients are used. No caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Visit Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open. Give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. Gardens are absolutely gorgeous here in the Pacific Northwest. If you have the chance to ever travel up into this area during the spring, oh, it's just breathtakingly gorgeous. And I know wherever you are really enjoying the warmer temperatures. In fact, it is something here in the Pacific Northwest, I think we're one of the cooler places in the country. We have just had this phenomenal wonderful weather. A little bit of rain may be falling today, but not much. Hey, I've got a recipe for you. If you like cornbread, if you're anything like me, you enjoy it, but sometimes I find that it's too bland. I like spicy stuff. Well, I've got a spiced masa corn muffin recipe that I wanted to share with you today because it is perfect for barbecue, and I think it's wonderful for a Sunday brunch and just to fix something special for yourself, and they really keep well. What you're going to need is to get your oven to about 375 degrees. This makes about 8 corn muffins, and if you like the super-sized muffins, I think you could divide it into a 6 super-sized muffin pan, and they'll just, you have to watch the temperature on it. We prefer the super-sized muffins. I know it's more calories, but it's really something we like. But check this out, and of course you could double this recipe if you like. Now what you're going to need is 2 tablespoons of fresh parsley leaves, 1 cup of unbleached all-purpose flour. You're going to need 3/4 of a cup of plain yogurt, 1/2 a cup of vegetable oil, 7 tablespoons of yellow instant masa mix or yellow cornmeal, 2 eggs, 1/4 of a cup of sugar, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, 1 teaspoon of dried red pepper flakes, 1/2 teaspoon of ground coriander, 1/2 a teaspoon of baking soda, 1/2 a teaspoon of salt, and of course, you're probably going to want to have lots of butter on the side. Anyway, what you want to do is make sure that your rack is in the center of your oven, and you want to spray your muffin tins with the nonstick cooking spray, or if you want, just use regular butter. It's up to you. But this is what you do. It's so easy, it's going to take just literally a minute or two to make. Your parsley, put it into your food processor, mince it up. Put in all of your other ingredients. That's right, all of it. And by the way, if you want to try sour cream with this instead of your yogurt, you can use sour cream too. Anyway, go ahead, process all the ingredients, 3 seconds in a food processor. You want to scrape once to scrape down the sides of the work bowl. And you want to continue processing just until it's all mixed. Remember, it's just going to take a little bit. If you're going to do this by hand, then you just need to know. You mix it until all the ingredients are moistened. You don't keep beating it. You don't want to do that. And then you put your batter in your prepared muffin cups. Bake them until they're ready to go. They'll be a light golden brown. It's going to be anywhere from 20 to 25 minutes if you use a bigger muffin pan. Might be, well, depend on the heat in your oven. It will be maybe 30 minutes, but I'd say 25 is probably when they're going to come out. Cool in the pan for a few minutes. Pop them out. Serve them warm with butter. Spicy, delicious, wonderful for barbecue. And it gives a pizzazz to something that otherwise is considered sort of bland. Donna Sebo here. I know we are just about out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. It's been an absolute delight sharing time with you today. And just know that you are so special, and I appreciate your being a part of the programming. And share the information about the show with your friends. Pass it on so that we can share more with you about the wonderful people that occupy this planet who take time to share their knowledge and wisdom with you. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Same time, same place, right here at BBS Radio. Enjoy your day, and remember to smile. Somebody needs your light. That'll put the beam right where it belongs. Take care. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.